How's everybody doing on the first really cold day? Not quite winter yet, but starting to feel that way. Especially commend you for coming out on this cold night. So tonight we're up to verse 41. When a superior man hears of the Tao, he immediately begins to embody it. When an average man hears of the Tao, he half believes it, half doubts it. When a foolish man hears of the Tao, he laughs out loud. If he didn't laugh, it wouldn't be the Tao. Thus it is said, the path into the light seems dark. The path forward seems to go back. The direct path seems long. True power seems weak. True purity seems tarnished. True steadfastness seems changeable. True clarity seems obscure. The greatest art seems unsophisticated. The greatest love seems indifferent. The greatest wisdom seems childish. The Tao is nowhere to be found, yet it nourishes and completes all things. So ironically, last week's verse, which was only four lines, I felt more impelled to speak directly and indirectly about it. This week's verse that's so much longer, on one level for us who are now 41 weeks into this text, it's so self-explanatory, I feel hardly a need to say much about it. What I want to talk about in a roundabout way of talking about this verse is the practices that we do here. I was in my car today for just about 10 minutes and I put the radio on, and it just happened to be the time when Dr. Dan Gottlieb has his Call a Shrink psychology show Monday afternoon. Voices in the Family, thank you. I like that show. I literally only caught 10 minutes. It was one of those in the car moments with NPR. And I don't even know the name of his guest, but they were talking about mindfulness meditation and psychotherapy. And it got me thinking about this class and how, although we've been teaching inspired by the verses of the Tao Te Ching, I've been bringing in so many readings from different traditions. We've had a wonderful inter-spiritual, inter-faith adventure these 41 weeks. And it's certainly not like I never talk about the practices, and certainly the greatest wisdom seems childish is perhaps not a bad description of what goes on in this class. And listening to this program today, it inspired me to talk to you more about the practices, about chanting, about why I'm such a strong proponent of chanting, how to work with chanting so it becomes a mindfulness practice. I think mindfulness meditation has become very, very popular in the West, in the last, really popular, I think, the last 10, 15 years. It seems like it's been so embraced by the medical community. It's the stress management RX that's given by many people, many doctors, many psychotherapists. I personally have always found mindfulness meditation a wonderful practice, but I consider it a very baseline practice. And I hardly talk about it. I come from a tradition that's all about if we can create an environment where people break open into the experience of their own, what we call in yoga, deep self, with a capital S, that's enough. The contact with the self And again, I'm speaking of the big self with a capital S. Contact with that self is all we need. That will do the trick. And everything else is dressing. Everything else is ornament on the experience. And so I can give teachings, I can bring readings, we can have satsang, we can have questions and answers, we can explore all kinds of philosophical texts. And that's lovely, there's nothing wrong with it. But that's still a mental process. And for me, the actual practice of chanting has a way of breaking people deeper and deeper inside, and in that way, opening up the pathways, opening up the portal into what we might call the gates of wisdom, the inner self, the fire of the self, the cave of the heart. There are so many metaphors we can use. The God within, whatever metaphor you want to use will do. One of the reasons we chant so much is because it's easier to chant in a group. And what I want to do is create an environment where you get so energized from Monday night chanting that you can take the inner, we call it the Shakti, that's nourished during chanting on Monday night. You can take it into your week and get maybe 3-4 days of good meditation on your own. And then you come back again for your recharge the following week. Which is not to say don't chant on your own, of course. Chant on your own if possible. It's easier in the group, it's more fun with the live instruments. Not quite the same when you're sitting home listening to your little iPod, chanting along with your iPod. But it's very important to understand that chanting and mantra repetition is also a mindfulness practice. And this is one of the points that I don't think we make very well in yoga. Because chanting comes out of what's called the bhakti tradition, which is a devotional tradition. And there's an aspect of it where you're just lost in the name, lost in the love of the name, lost in the opening, lost in the fire of opening, lost in the fire of love. And we get into very ecstatic bliss states. And bliss states can be rather addictive and somewhat trancy. And so we can get into what I call a bypass, where we're so tranced out from the chanting that we're actually quite disassociated from what we might call the mind-body system. That kind of chanting, it's fine, it won't hurt you. It's a lot better than, I don't know, drinking a bottle of wine. Well, drinking a bottle of wine won't take you to those states because it's more of a depressant. But other indulgences that people have that are more moving in the other directions of consciousness expansion. The kind of just bliss out, trance out chanting that's not also held in a container of awareness. It's like a drug. It's like, whatever. I don't happen to use any of those, but I guess, I don't know, smoking a few joints with your friends, you'll get high. But this is not about getting high. We do get high because we're going higher and higher. If we don't also go deeper and deeper and lower, there's no anchor, there's no ground for the ecstasy and the bliss and the heights that we move into. And so in the end, I don't want to say there's no fruit, and I also don't want to say we do a practice for the fruit. Ultimately, we do practice for the sake of practice. As we begin to understand, being in the present moment is the greatest place we can be. If we could just simply be in the present moment, all the suffering goes away. Because in the present moment, there's nothing but the present moment. This is what the Tao Te Ching is saying over and over and over again, week after week, verse after verse, word after word, this whole long number 41. That's really what it's saying. So when you chant, You don't want to let yourself just go into trance out land. For a moment or two, it's fine. But at a certain point, you want to come down and you want to become aware of every sensation, every pulsation within you. You want to be working to become more and more conscious, more and more alive in every cell. And the wonderful thing about the chanting is it does ignite the inner fire. It does ignite the inner light. And so if we work with that light, rather than just let ourselves trance out on the light, that light will pull us deeper and deeper inside and break open more and more awareness inside of us. So again, you want to use the chanting not as a bliss out, not as a space out, not as a background to your own whatever, thinking, planning, writing, whatever. You want to use the chanting as a vehicle to pull you deeper and deeper inside. And in that indrawn pulling, you will open more and more space inside of yourself. You will break open more and more bliss inside of you. But it's a bliss that's so grounded, it will carry you through all the hard, dark places that we face day in, day out, in our outer lives and in our inner lives. Another one of the curiosities of chanting is it's working with the ears. It's working with hearing. It's working with listening. Sound is coming into the ears. It's going right into the brain. Now, it's going into the brain through the eyes. It's going into the brain through all the senses. But the ears, they're further away than the other sense organs. I can't quite put it in words, but if you think about it, you'll understand, I think, what I'm saying. There's something about the immediacy of the sound coming in on this side and this side. It's a total experience. When it's coming in the eyes, it's just kind of coming in this one direction. When it's coming in the ears, it's coming in from your two sides. There's something really profound about that. And so listening, the more finely we listen, the more possibility there is of waking up more of the brain. You know, how many times have you heard, we only use whatever it is, you know, 10% of our capacity or our potential? Chanting, if you really use chanting, not just as a drug to bliss out on, but as an awareness practice, you are charging your brain with more and more currents of very fine energy. Another aspect of chanting, it's not just internal, it goes into the room. It's a force in the room. It's a living, moving, energetic presence in the room that we generate together. And it moves and shapes everyone just by sitting in the room, in the enveloping waves of the shakti, the energy that's generated and actually created through the process of chanting. So inside of you, things are happening. Outside of you, something is happening, and it all works together to mold and shape and refine and deepen and ultimately pull you deeper and deeper inside yourself, where you will contact more and more of your own death. And on the chanting journey, just like on a meditation journey, we are going to encounter all the obstacles, because chanting tends to be more distracting for the mind than meditation. We don't necessarily bump up against all the edges that we do in meditation. In meditation, it's you and your mind, and the mind usually wins out. In chanting, there's a hope that the heart will win out. And because of that, you want to use the practice even more. You want to really work it. You want to let yourself be really conscious, really listening, and paying attention to everything. The shape of your mouth, the way your tongue feels, the way your body is. Are you open? Are you sitting straight? How is your posture? How are your legs? It's not that we rule out asana in this class. We want the chanting to align us in more and more integration of the entire mind-body system. If I'm doing my job and you're doing yours, when you leave this class, you should feel as good as you feel after 90 minutes or 2 hours of an asana class. If you don't, I'm failing you and you're failing yourself. So you want to bring more and more awareness to the process. And more, you'll laugh because last week I was railing against words like intention. But you want to do bring more and more intentionality into the process. You know, if you're not feeling well, you want to just come lean up against the wall and space out, of course. Of course, if you want to just lie down and soak it in, of course. But only let yourself have that indulgence once in a while. Come to class really wanting to work it. Wanting to take the practice and milk it for everything you can get out of it. And more awareness. Awareness is the greatest gift. Awareness changes everything. Awareness is, it's the voice of the self. It's the light of the self. It's the breeze of the self. And as we allow awareness to flood through us and really speak to us, everything gets easy. Insight comes a mile a minute. Answers right there, opening into more and more layers of our own core strength. That's what yoga is about. Right? It's about opening into that deep self. It's about union with. There's no word for it. The great isness of what we now are going to be calling, after last week, non-being, right? We've moved from being to non-being. So funny, some people said last week, God, your talk was so technical, it put me to sleep. And I agree, it was pretty technical. Though I must say, I finished editing it today, posted it up on the blog before I came over here. And it's actually not such a bad talk as I thought. It's worth listening to, especially at the end. Once I stop all the technical stuff, it actually really gets pretty interesting. You know, the mind, it's such an interesting thing, the mind. The person on Dan Gottlieb's show today, the guest, again, whose name I don't know, this woman was talking about her monkey mind, and he said something, you know, Gottlieb said, well, I've been meditating seriously for 10 years, I still have a monkey mind. And the guest also said, well, yeah, you know, that's what the mind does. And you want your mind to think, you want your mind to plan, you want your mind to strategize, and this is true. But we want to train the mind so it's very well behaved. We want to train the mind so it's thinking when it's supposed to be thinking, but when it's supposed to be sitting in stillness and opening into stillness and receiving the grace of its source, which would be the self, it shuts up and allows stillness, allows wonder, allows awareness, allows magnificence, allows clarity to just break open and infuse the entire being with that. The mind is an incredible, incredible instrument, incredibly powerful instrument, and we want to use it. We want to develop discernment. We want to develop discrimination. We want to be very smart about everything. We want to develop really skillful means so that whatever situation we find ourselves in, we handle it with the most power. And for that, we need the mind. But if the mind does not understand how to quiet and open and surrender into the greater depth it sits inside of, and that from the yogic perspective is considered the source of that mind, forget about it. This is how we get burnout. And so we want the mind to remember where it comes from. When I was talking last week about the four levels of sound, which I'm going to talk about some more in the coming weeks, not so much tonight, but I'll just say a little bit more about that. if you think of that first level, the pada level of sound, as the sort of the entryway into non-being, or the self, or being, whatever words you want to use, the entryway into the luminosity of you. And sound, when we're talking about the four levels of sound, sometimes it remains in the thought. It never even makes it out of the mouth. But a sound moves through as the impulse to sound moves up through the four levels of sound. It goes through all kinds of permutations before it ever comes out the mouth, depending on what it contacts in the inner journey. And so as the mind learns to just open and still and surrender down into that so-called pada level of sound, there's tremendous stillness. But if it encounters all the thinking, 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 worry, 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 pain, 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 wound, 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 blah, 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 it gets so crunched and warped and distorted as it finds its way up. And we end up with a monkey mind. So we want to train the mind to relax. And we do that through paying attention. Paying attention to whatever is unfolding in any given moment. That's what mindfulness meditation is. And we can use chanting in the same way. We can pay attention while we're chanting. When we chant, we'll start in a moment, we'll chant Om Namah Shivaya. We generally chant Om Namah Shivaya for 20 minutes. While you're chanting, listen when I sing the call, and listen when you sing the response. Feel the responses in your body and the responses in your mind when I sing the call, and feel the way you feel, and pay attention to whatever is arising as you sing the response. Again, don't just get all tranced out in this sonic vibration. Work with the sonic vibration. Let the sonic vibration be a medicine that you're consciously ingesting and using as a tool or a technique or a means to break your own being more wide open. Break being into non-being.